Thank you. I'm Peter Schmidt. I teach in the English department here, and I'm doing a course that's basically a survey course of poetry in English, including medieval to the present, and it has a section on translation. And so that was a great opportunity to take advantage of the fact that Swarthmore grad and friend Daisy Fried has been doing a translation project that started during the COVID era of Baudelaire's work, translation adaptation after Baudelaire, it's called. She's published 3 volumes of poetry that are really amazing, and they have great titles. My Brother is Getting Arrested Again, one. She Didn't Mean to Do It. And also Women's Poetry, Poems and Advice. And she gave a reading with a Pulitzer-winning poet who thought that that book was actually not a collection of poems, but an anthology, and asked her whether the poems had been, whether she was going to do more anthologies or not. It's not an anthology so much as it is a parody of different ideas that people, or cliches that they bring about the assumption of what a woman's poem is. And then it works in very inventive ways to counter that and to suggest other possibilities for women's poetry. She's going to read and talk about the, introduce the various poems from the translation book today. And then she and I will have a brief conversation afterwards with a couple questions. And then we'll very quickly open things up to you all for reactions and questions and things. Okay? So welcome again, and welcome back, Daisy.
Thank you. It's good to be back at the mothership. And I understand this is the very first time. Oh, I'm told I can take this off. I put on lipstick for the first time in 2 years. Thank you, Peter, and thank you, McCabe Library. I'm going to just talk a little bit about the project, which happened by accident. I address this in my book. I'm going to read a little bit from the foreword. By the way, I do have books for sale. I'm giving a Swarthmore discount, $10 per book. So if you want one, they're in back, and Natalie Anderson will sell them. The famous Natalie Anderson will sell them to you. So the thing is, I don't know French very well, and I don't like Baudelaire that much. He's full of decay and pestilence and death and adjectives, too many adjectives. He invokes muses all the time, classical figures, goddesses, personifications. He's more self-centered than I am. But his disgust, he's full of disgust, but his disgust is kind of diagnostic, and it's glorious. And he's always most revolted by himself. I think that we in America could use more self-disgust sometimes. I started messing around with Baudelaire in the spring of 2020. My husband was slowly dying of a very cruel disease, which affected his body, attacked his body and his mind. He was in a hospital bed in the living room. And for quite a while, we didn't have any help to speak of. It was a really tough time. We got COVID too. It was mild cases. But all of this stuff was sort of going on in my life, and I didn't have a whole lot of time to write poetry. One day I was stealing a few rare minutes for myself, and I pulled a book of John Ashbery translations from the French off the shelf. What was happening was, because I didn't have any time to write, and nobody has any attention span anymore, but I really didn't have any attention span, I decided I would read at least 2 poems every day alphabetically, from my poetry library in alphabetical order. I had been through Agudelo, Amichai, Ammons, Anderson, and Ashbery came next. And I didn't have enough brain power to read, you know, Convex Mirror or anything like that. So I pulled off the Baudelaire, his French translations, looked up the one Baudelaire he had translated, and discovered that it was Paysage, which means landscape, and I thought that it was a lousy translation. I thought it was bouncy and chimey. Maybe it was Ashbury-ish. You know, maybe that was his intention. But I thought, I can do better. So that's how I think a lot of translation projects start. This is the poem that this all started with. This is Paysage, which means landscape. To compose my sexless eclogues, I will bed down near the sky like the astrologers, and neighbor to bell towers, listen dreamily to the somber wind-carried hymns. Chin in hand, high up under the slant roof, I'll see the factories chatter and sing-song, their chimneys and steeples, those masts of the city, and the giant sky dreaming of eternity. It's sweet through mists to watch a star born in the blue, lamp at the window, rivers of coal climbing the sky, moon pouring sorcery. Up there, I'll see springtime, I'll see summer, fall. And when the winter comes with monotone snow, I'll close curtains and blinds and build my fairy palaces in the night. I'll dream of blue, bright horizons, of gardens, of fountains crying in alabaster, of kisses, birds singing evening and morning, all that infantile idyll. And when riot storms impotent at my window, I won't get up from my desk. I'll be plunged voluptuous in calling forth spring by force of will, freezing sunshine from my heart, making of my burning thoughts a gentler weather. So this seemed like, when I got done, I thought, wait a minute, this is a quarantine poem. You know, it's Baudelaire in his attic and the mob outside dreaming of eternity. This was also at the time George Floyd had been murdered in Minnesota, and there were demonstrations in Philadelphia and all over. And so there were literal mobs in the streets. And so I just thought this is, this translation gave me a joy in making that I hadn't felt in a long time. So I said, I'm going to try more, because I couldn't. It was too hard for me to start with a blank page and to not know where I was going. So this gave me a kind of structure. But what happened was I started to move away from attempting to sort of translate things. Very soon, I just wanted to sort of take over the poems and run them through my own idiom. And I started to move some of them to Philadelphia in 2020. A time when... it was just that Baudelaire seemed to me to have a lot to say about life in 2020. Illness, losing one's beloved, a corrupt, violent, economically spiraling country, led by an incompetent, malignant narcissist, with all kinds of racist institutions, and people in crisis. And so there's just something about his over-the-topness felt right. So what somebody described it to me as I was running it through my own nervous system. Some of them went pretty far from the original. So for example, daybreak is after le crepuscule du matin, which means crepuscule in French is both dawn and dusk. But this is the morning crepuscule, and I call it daybreak. Helicopters sang out in the South Philly sky, and morning wind blew branches against our windows. It was the hour my dream swarm twisted me pale on my pillow, when like a bloodshot eye, darting and twitching, the last lamp stained the day in carnadine, where, trapped in my surly body, I recast the battle between lamp and day as my struggle between intention and accident. And like a face wiped dry by breezes, the air was full of thrilling, fleeing things, anger, change. I was tired of writing, or you were. You were tired of fucking, or I was. This and that torched boutique sent up smoke. Somebody heaved a planter into another store window. The shopkeeper put the safety back on his sidearm, with stinging eyes dialed his insurance adjuster. Someone danced on a police car. Someone blew up an ATM and his hand off with it. Women who forgot to stop bearing children mopped their brows and chewed on ice. It was the hour when, sweating and starving, they gave birth to their latest, moaning and cursing. Like a sob cut short by foaming blood, a siren, another, tore through the fabric of morning. Buildings snuffled like marine mammals bedded down in smog sea. Old ones in nursing homes, their minds gone, hawked up last juddering breaths. They'd been abandoned, as sometimes I wish to abandon you. Someone crept home broken by stupidity. Shivery dawn in her green-pink shift crawls up the Schuylkill into the parklands. Angry filly, rubbing her eyes, grabs up her tools again. That old worker. So, Baudelaire has a poem called Une gravure fantastique, which is a strange engraving. And my poem uses imagery from this Steve Sacks political cartoon, which is Trump's brain, and this is Trump, and his head is like a tank hatch, and this is Stephen Miller coming out of it, and then a KKK guy, white nationalist guy on top. So this is my gravure fantastique, strange engraving. This ghoul has clamped to his cadaverous dome a diadem in the shape of a cone signifying hate. Without spurs or whip, he drives like a tank, the pale horse, apocalyptic hack who drools from his nose like a snuffling cokehead. Through spacious skies, together they thunder, trampling with hazardous hoofs the multitudes. A crackling and rattling of money. A growl in the mind moans from maws. The rider with flaming tiki parades over crowds, his steed crushes, and rooting out traitors to his cause, gallops over a graveyard nation, where, stacked as far as the eye can see by fever light of a black sun, are body on body of those who perished by his bloody jobbery. That's dedicated to Stephen Miller. One of the things I did throughout here was to change when Baudelaire is a man looking at a woman, change the perspective to a woman, sometimes looking at men. In this one, this is called The Soul of Wine, and it's in it basically wine speaks to the woman. Okay. And I believe I changed the son to a daughter and the wife to a husband. Okay. The Soul of Wine. One night, wine sang in the bottles. O woman disowned, this is the wine talking, O woman disowned, from my prison of glass and red sealing wax, to you I give a song of light and sisterhood. I know how, on the flaming fell, it takes murderous toil under a baking sun to give me life and soul. Gratitude. To you I won't be vicious. Such joy to tumble down the throat of a woman like you, exhausted by work. Your warm belly's my sweet rest. Better pleasure there than in the cold vault. Can you hear the Sabbath canticles singing out in my breast, sobbing with hope? Elbows plunked on table, sleeves rolled, worship me and be contented. I'll ignite your ravished husband's eyes. To your daughter I'll return luster and metal, and be for her, frail wrestler of life, the oil for her muscles. Into you I, fruity ambrosia, fall, precious seed sown by the sower. So from our amour grows poetry, spurting toward God like a flower. It's kind of a ridiculous ending, but it's not my fault, it's Baudelaire, so. Okay. There were some times when I was doing this where I was kind of like, well, a lot of times I would never say that in a poem. I'm like, I don't talk like that. And like, that's one of those times, but then I was like, but this is fun. I get to talk like that in a poem, right? Owls. In black yew shelters, owls tuck themselves away. Strange gods, with red meditating shifty eyes, otherwise roost unstirring till the melancholy hour when darkness shovels the sun off stage. Thus, they teach the sage, she need fear in this world only tumult and action. Passing, drunk on shadows, my punishment for desiring change is desiring more change. Okay. This is Jules. Les Bijoux, the original, was censored in Baudelaire's time for being likely to lead to the excitement of the senses by a crude realism offensive to public decency. I can tell you, if you send this to somebody you're into, it works. Okay. Jules, my man gets naked, and knowing my hunger, the family jewels are all he wears. This gives him an air of opulence, playing stud in the seraglio. When he dances, virile and mocking, he seems made of a world of rock and steel, so that I may, in beguiled fury, adore his whole body, paunch and luster. So he's lying there, letting himself be loved, and from the top of the chaise smirks with pleasure at my lust, deep and sweet as the ocean that tidal climbs a cliff. His eyes on me are a barely tamed tiger's. He plays vague and dreamy, strikes poses of animal lust and ravishment, satisfying me with every twist and thrust. And his arms and leg and his thigh and ass, polished like oil, pumping like the neck of a swan, pass before me. And now I feel becalmed. And his belly and his clusters and vine advance then, tempter, disturb my soul's response, my zen, lure me from my crystalline calm where I thought I might lonely rest a while. And now I swear I can see Apollo united to Priapus in hairy chest, bit of a belly, and below his narrow, dressy pelvis. The tawny textures are superb. And the lamp has resigned itself to die, and the flickering hearth barely lights the room. And every time he sighs his sigh, he swamps us both with his electricity. And again, it's not my fault. So, Baudelaire had four poems called Spleen. And spleen was, melancholy, boredom, dissatisfaction. I translated or adapted these poems, but I translated the word as temper. I'll read you two of them. Temper. I got more crap up here than if I lived 1,000 years. A filing cabinet stuffed with credit card statements, doggerel, love letters, subpoenas, paperback novels, heavy locks of sex partners' hair folded up in paper, hides fewer secrets than my blasted brain. It's a mausoleum, enormous walk-in freezer, holds more dead than a mass grave. I'm a graveyard the moon hates, where remorse is the tunneling worm chomping through my dearest departeds. I'm an old bedroom stuffed with wilted roses, strewn with last year's cast-off fashions, where sick pastels of fatted Boucher babies stink of talc and the open bottle. The limping days are so fucking long, snowed under by years and years and years and years. Say it. Boredom born of apathy achieves immortality. Body, you're nothing. Bag of dread and granite crag, magma cooled. Old sphinx in a fog mumbling to self, forgotten by the whole giddy world, haranguing in a dwindling light. Temper. I'm like the provost they used to call Rainmaker. Endowed but impotent, gleaming but spent. disdaining lecturers lick spittling his boots, as you might be bored with puppies and other beasts. Nothing can cheer him, no promotion or publication, nor students demonstrating in front of his window. His favorite admin, grotesquely singing his praises, no longer amuses. To be honest, he's twisted and sick. His stand-up desk resembles a sarcophagus. The suck-ups, for whom all bosses are beautiful, no longer know how to please. Elicit no simper from his manscaped face. His chief alchemist in HR hasn't been able to leech out tainting corruption. They tried furloughing full-timers, the bloodbath they called it, failed to restore institutional health. He doesn't know how to warm his dazed brains. Nothing but buzzwords running in his veins. So that's not about Swarthmore, though. Let's see. The Broken Bell. I like winter nights to find in a heat lamp that beats and fumes, old memories rising in the banging of church bells through the snow spray. Blessed be the bell of liberty that ancient keeps trying to ring, tossing out his faithful cry like an old soldier in his bunker on the eve of battle. My soul's broken, and when I want songs of trouble, it often happens that his voice weakens like the death rattle of a forgotten man by a lake of blood under a pile of the dead who dies without moving in struggle. Got two more Baudelaires and then two regular Daisy poems. So the Baudelaire's, I think, one of his greatest poems, The Swan, Le Cygne, is about Paris changing, about modernity on the march. I transferred the poem to Philly in 2020. He starts by invoking Andromache, who's Hector's widow. She's a big figure of mourning. But I also, her name appears to mean etymologically fighter of men. So I couldn't resist that. So Mockbird is not a swan, it's a goose. So this is called The Goose. Andromache, widow, fighter of men. I think of you by the poor mirror of the river which glitters with grieving, seems to show by its slow, full float the size of our sadness. It seeds my memory, walking where the road carousels. Everything bewilders. A city changes faster than a human heart. That's a field, there houses and the grasses, green blocks where water puddled. Upriver, a zoo, giraffes hung their faces over a wall. We took our girl, arriving early, the hour the air was cold and clear. There I live in memory. And here I live, Andromache, in the dull what is. Then sweaty work wakens, traffic awakens to make of the silence a dark hurricane. And there's a goose, separated from its hateful shitting gaggle that marauds by the boathouses, rasps webs over the macadam, dodges fast cars. His stained hind plumage trails on the ground. He shambles near the disk of the enormous fountain. Dry and silent since disease broke on us. Dry since the city emptied itself of itself. Emptied its people only to rooms. Dry the bronze breasts of the river spirit statues. The bird shit stained spouting bronze swans they hoist on their shoulders. Dry maud. As if the ruins of a beloved, his broken cornices, sprawled stone blocks stained green, can be forgotten. No kids playing there, nor older folks coming back to ill-advised life for an early dark morning drunken grope. Nope, just the living goose, nervously bathing wings in brimming filth, scum, dung, rotten leaves. He opens his beak, heart full of his native lake he'll never return to, as if to say, Water, when will you rain? Sky, when lightning? Thunder. Unlucky bird, son of the sun, you stretch your pumping neck up and up toward the hazy azure, as if, like me, you're blaming God, who doesn't exist. Our Philly changes. I wander back into glass canyons between unleasable new office towers. And in their bases, shuttered shops with bric-a-brac displayed unbought in ghastly windows. Empty bars and restaurants, their outdoor tables barely inhabited. Heat lamp flames warming air where people aren't. Trucks hitting wrinkle bumps, distant sirens, sirens, sirens. Scaffolding, rehabs paused, old mini-mansions, roofs fallen in. Laborers for insurance law firms hunched at screens working for the market. Everything metaphor for memories heavier than rocks. Outside the Rodin Museum, images oppress me, dour thinker and gates of hell. And my great goose, with his crazy motions, and then you, Andromache, ridiculous, sublime, like and not at all like the protesters, in their playing field encampment of nylon and polyester and teals and grays, pegged with cords to tired trees, with laundry hung between, and Black Lives Matter and other signs, no cop zone, housing now, our demands, long list. Some sit stoned, some march about, the grass remains a stretch of emerald. I don't want to say I'm gnawed by longing for a man like a city, city like a man whose mind's a ruined city. I'm bored with these feelings they call grief. Andromache, fighter, your husband ripped from you. You felt a captive beast wandering deserted streets, heavy, aching, widow of the world. One protester emerged from the mass, tripped on a tent wire, and crying, cursed into a bullhorn, muttered something about a mama hugging, soothing them, keeping them safe. And the man I love said, "You think my eyes are pretty? Oh, you should have seen my mother's eyes. They were the most beautiful blue." The last, most lucid thing he said to me. Old memory, like a lost goose vanishing, honks out a full note. What good to think of others forgotten, kneeled on, jailed, killed, defeated, robbed, so many others more. So, in his famous poem, Correspondences, Baudelaire depicts nature as a majestic but indecipherable force, I think, and believes that it's the poet who, through metaphor and symbol and synesthesia, can translate nature to the human world. I'm a person who's quite resistant to the ineffable, so I translated this one seriously because Nat asked me to, so otherwise I probably wouldn't have. She was teaching the poem in late 2020, is that what it was? And she wanted a modern version to go along with other people's versions, so I was like, okay, because when Nat asked me to do something, I do it. So I was actually really pleased with the result, made it the last poem in my book. But just to give you a sense of what other translations might sound like, I just pulled this off. I don't even know who this is. I pulled this off the internet. So this is how it might sound more literally translated into English. Nature is a temple where living pillars let escape sometimes confused words. Man traverses it through forests of symbols that observe him with familiar glances. And like, you know, I say like nature is a temple where living pillars. I'm like, oh God, you know. I'm like, I'm not gonna, you know. Anyway, so, but I was like, I'll do it. So here's my correspondences. Our woods today was a temple where living pillars whispered leaf words, bark words. A woman passing there crosses a forest of symbols in the lichens, the mosses, the schist on the hillside, which watch her with knowing glances. Like faraway echoes, their shadowy, complex entwining was vast as night in the clear light of day, in the deepnesses between trees, and the chasm the creek carved. So your smells, colors, the sounds you made, I remember them, correspond. Scents fresh as infant skin, sweet as oboes, prairie green, and others, mulchy and rich, becoming compost, expanding infinite as amber, musk, resin, and incense, to sing the soarings of my spirit and senses. So those are my some Baudelaire from the year the city emptied. I'm gonna just Peter asked me maybe like how has he, I think he, you know how has working on this project affected your own poetry, and these two poems might be part of that answer. This you've seen have anybody seen the immersive Van Gogh, you know. They blow up Van Gogh's really big, and you walk inside, and you can be inside a Van Gogh painting, right? So this concept kind of fascinates me. So this poem kind of riffs on that. It's called Step Inside Van Gogh, because that's what they say, Step Inside Van Gogh. Night, for $65, will froth and flow. And shapes between the orbiting clouds intensify their indigo, while doleful chipper imogen heat cools the moonlight fever of the stars in ambient warble. The sounds the shake between you and me. A foothill village lifted by its glow, the trees a knife, it's not a flame. That's not Saint Remy, it's in your head. Immersive spectacle, take me in, take from me my disease and sorrow dream. But Bosch immersive might be fun, you riffing say. And we begin to joke of poker rings in orifices, of bodies stretched on racks like hospital beds. Never mind, I like the godlike feeling I get peering in on all that suffering contained in smallish frames, in smallish galleries, a scale to reiterate proportion and intensity. Never mind, I love looking like deities at what humans do, eschewing intervention. Imagine what spectacle could with Kahlo cause per ad copy to come to life. This is really true. Ice pick they got Trotsky with, impalement by trolley bar, the limping legs, that brow, or a version augmented of what I saw in the water. Enter the scenario between her thighs as if she's giving birth to you. Lacquered toes propped on tub slab, stale water into which she farts, scenes of autobio. Skyscraper, the Empire State, burning inside a volcano. Conch shell full of bullet holes, woman strangled with a rope, blood that drips from bathtub plug, and curling, caresses hallux, joins the water. No, put her away, her disorder, possibility, and pain. Give me Goya's black work instead to walk in, that I may drown with dog in quicksand, while an old man starves with soup, while crones circled for a sacrifice quail before the goat god, and Saturn eats my head. Else battles, redemption, no such thing. Else rebellion in the streets. A man hangs from a tree, dead sticks. Life, cast it off. A rifle blooms with death. Only $65 to sever from me remembrance of kisses and embraces. Let me live far from fading shadow of my dead. Stupidity, dull and bright, a long way from my ombre dread. Last word is dread. And this is my last poem. One of the things I really wanted to do was write shorter poems. So I ended up writing 5 short poems, more than 1 poem. So I don't know if that really counts. But I wanted to get in and out fast. So let's see if this is called Quickies in Widowhood, with 3 instances of laughter, 1 not narrated, 2 instances of crying. 1, flies. First crush after. Amid the whiteness of cheeses, corn puffs, icing-coated animal crackers, the salt and milk, napkins, even the plasticware, at my sidewalk picnic, the neighborhood flies were already beside themselves with delight when I poured him a snifter of tawnier brandy. Then they swarmed as he swirled and opened his mouth to sip. I watched his tongue, pink writhing muscle. He spat after one fly tried to settle there. Two, blister for Maisie. You showed me the place your snake pants melted where you touched them by accident to the metal of the flaming chiminea, but did not show me where the knob of your big toe blistered up to pain you when you tried to walk normally, nor did you explain why you were barefoot in January. All I know is you were laughing till you screamed all afternoon out there that day with your friends, first time since your dad died. Three. Times we had to pause recording the podcast or little essay on the emotions for Glorious and Sebastian. First, with the poem about the nursing home, I started to cry right as we figured out the exact moment collective changed to subjective consciousness. Then, when you two were explaining Aristotle's continent man and thinking about poopy pants, I couldn't find it in myself to stop snickering. Four, let's fly to the castle. It wasn't your bomber, old boots, duplicate copy of the Shaw bio, or your wheelchairs that made me feel I couldn't breathe. I was glad to see those go. But our girl's Princess Celestia, she who raises the sun and moon in the land of Equestria, that feminine ponytopia. Trebling, my hair is so pretty. In weakening voice from inside the 30-gallon garbage bag I dropped at the curb. Guilty, crying, I dashed to save them from my zeal and determination, to fish back Twilight Sparkle, Pinkie Pie, Rainbow Dash, Rarity and Applejack, Fluttershy and Zecora, even Nightmare Moon, but especially the princess, and ran barefoot, no bra. All I saw was the garbage truck, the men hanging on, disappearing around the corner, pale pony princess with blue and green artificial hair churning in its maw. Five, Yahrzeit is the Jewish tradition. It's a year after your beloved dies, and you light a candle. Yahrzeit. My thought. Am I pronouncing that right?
Yahrzeit.
Yahrzeit. Thank you. Yahrzeit. My thought. After the rioters, the Vermont mittens, and supple purple leather gloves. After the snowstorms of uncharacteristic timing and volume. The scolding and shitstorms, after vaccines and sickenings, after the angers and fears, after hurricanes set up their artistic swirl shapes on the weather channels and radar apps, and rock and roll and cello sonatas and Texas and dread, and falling in love again, my thought was, strange, you're still dead. Anyways, I'm sitting on my boyfriend's deck all the way on the other side of the great land, watching all the colors going golden, or all sherbety ascending a hillside, and my mind thinks out there all on its own, oh good, and soon you'll get home and we'll all be here. The wind snuffs the candle my boyfriend lit for his wife. Oh shit, he says, a look on his face. Relights it, moves it out of the window. The vista going purple, plums ripening, tall tree points its tip at the raven who caws blackly iridescent at its top. Thank you.
Okay, we'll have brief conversation, we'll open things up for questions. There's also books back in the back for sale if you'd like to buy some. Thanks. So Daisy, could we talk for a second about the goose poem?
Yeah.
And your sense of how you wanted to use Baudelaire, but also add all these changes and additions, and in some ways make Baudelaire new, I think, not just updated, but to make the contrast between the sublime and the ridiculous, which is kind of at the heart of the poem, new again. And I'm really fascinated with lots of the changes that you've made, but especially the ending. I looked at some of the translations of Baudelaire and also at the French, and it's fascinating. The last stanza is full of references to a forest where Baudelaire can retreat in safety from all of the chaos around him in the city of Paris. There's also this sound of a memory, ancient memory, that he describes as like a hunting horn, or at least that's one of the ways that it's translated, like a hunt is happening in the forest and stuff. He's also very proud to say that he's, I think of the captives, the vanquished, the vanished, and so many more. And the shifts that you make to that is really striking to me. The whole poem is incredibly moving, I think, as a way both of talking about grief and your grief and things, but also the sort of way modernity promises so much and then alienates us. Some of the major changes that you did was to have Baudelaire ask a question, or to question, or to have your voice ask the question of what good is all of this sympathy? Like we're trying to think of those who are vanquished. And instead of being very vague about the vanquished and the defeated, you add a bunch of very powerful, very specific adjectives, including somebody who's been kneeled on and died because of being kneeled on. And we probably all know what that is in reference to. And I'm just, I guess a big simple question here is your thoughts about how you came up with those shifts and changes. If you can remember the creative process, or how you make sense of them now, what you did.
Thinking back, I don't feel like I've really studied or processed the Baudelaire poems. And I think my resistance to doing that was useful to me.
Yeah, especially his romanticism and stuff.
What do I take? What don't I take? And I knew that I wanted to. I was saying some of you were in Peter's class today, and I was saying I knew I wanted to get rid of a lot of his Latinate language, and I knew I wanted to because it's hard to make that stuff be feeling in English, I think. And I knew that I wanted to, use fewer adjectives and make it sound something closer to how I would talk. I mean, these are obviously not exactly conversational poems, but I wanted to sort of play in and out of idiomatic. So I was really thinking a lot about sound as I went along. I was thinking about sort of how the parts go together, how the energies of things. I think one of the things I think about in all poems is almost maybe like a painter would think about a canvas. I think even an abstract painter, you put this color up here and you put this color down here to create some kind of balance or imbalance. So I was thinking about the structure. What comes first? What comes next? How do they balance each other out? How do they create? And I knew I wanted to get some personal story in, because that's what I was doing with a lot of these poems was bringing my own story in and sort of avoiding the openly philosophical, although I went there, I ventriloquized that, I took images. I mean, some of these images, I think, I don't remember very well. Andromache's there. It starts out the mirror of the river glittering with grieving is, very related to what he does, I think. A city changes, that exclamation, I think, is direct translation. Mm-hmm. Obviously, he didn't have a giraffe at the zoo, and he didn't have, what else? My swan does a lot of the things that his swan does. So his swan opens his mouth and seems to be calling out to the empty universe. Mm-hmm. Where's God? Basically, when are we going to get solace? When are we going to get things? When will things be better? But I wanted it to be at Logan Circle in Philly. Some of you know Philly will have recognized that. Rodin Museum is right up there, and it kind of tickled me to put Rodin and the Thinker in there. Same century as and location, as Baudelaire.
And a Canada goose, of which they're all over Philly.
Right. And other cat, right. So, like, you know, it's like a plague up there. Although a friend of mine who read this poem was like, you know, you're really not getting the geography quite right. I've never seen a Canada goose down by Logan Circle. They stay up by Kelly Drive. You know, I'm like, stop. Yeah. So what? So, like, I was doing stuff like that. And I also wanted to get a feeling of what the city was like the first year of COVID, when everybody was really just staying home. Nobody was vaccinated. Restaurants were trying to get people to go, you know, heat lamps and things, but things were pretty empty, and it felt like a strange neutron bomb feeling for the early days of COVID, right? So that was going on. And then I think I wanted my, you know, my private loss and the collective loss to be coming in there. And I always want, well, I don't, I'm always is too strong a word, but I often like it when, I mean, if I'm wandering around in the city, one of the things I think about is politics and who am I seeing? And during that time, there were people camped out on the parkway at Tent City. And so I was sort of just trying to do some kind of reporting in a way. I have a, I used, long ago, I was worked as a journalist, so I sort of tend to record things in my mind or on paper, like what I see. So I wanted all these things to come together. And in that kind of technique is actually pretty similar to what I do in when I'm writing my poems, which is like just sort of gather things from other places. And in this case, Baudelaire got me the structure. I knew I wanted to get to this list at the end. I knew I wanted it to be contemporary. I knew I wanted my own personal life to be talking to the public life, the political life of the city, and vice versa. So.
Okay, thanks. One other just quick question. You used a small press that's based in the Midwest, and I wonder if you could talk a little bit about your sense of the role that small presses play just in the poetry network and helping sustain things.
Well, I mean, there's a few big New York presses that publish poetry, and there's some kind of powerhouse independent presses. But there are a lot of poets doing incredible work, and poetry doesn't sell very well. So what do? You know. So there are a lot of university presses. My other books, I was with a university press. This one was such a short book. I thought it was going to be a chat book. And I knew I needed to find I didn't even approach Pittsburgh with it, actually, for a number of reasons. But so what the small press could do, it's an odd project. It's a niche. Do we say niche or do we say niche?
Niche.
Okay, it's a niche project. And this press in particular does, I think, really gorgeous books, really exquisite books, odd books. They have some big names, but things that are sort of fall through the cracks of other places. So a lot of the independent presses are able to do this, right? And they're able to make really good products and send them out and distribute them. And I think that, the ones that do it well, like Flood Editions, it's a labor of love. And they put a lot of effort into the book. And it's what, you know, I think, like, he puts out a few books a year, and this is a big one for him. So he's going to do a lot to support this book, which, you know, the New York presses they have good resources, but they're likely to, you know, go with their best-selling novel, right? You know, and some of them have poetry, you know, so you're not necessarily the star of that press. It was a lot of discussion about order of poems and sort of just a lot of trustworthiness I felt here. So I think that the independent presses can do that kind of thing in poetry. And I think that a lot of, you know, myself and my presses side, I think a lot of what's exciting going on in poetry is with these smaller presses. So,
yeah. That's a good way to find small presses, is to look at where other poets publish and things like that.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And you had a say in the amazing cover.
Well, my friend Richard introduced me to Paul Auriga. So then she's an amazing artist, and this is a series of dog woman. This is her dog woman paintings, and she actually did these dog woman paintings while her husband was dying, and there are these portraits of her tenderness and also extreme emotion. But she does a lot of this. This is a pastel. She does a lot of pictures of women. So what happened was we wrote to her gallery, and they gave permission to use it. So.
Wow. Yeah. Questions? Comments?
Yeah.
I have a question about the poem that you read.
Yeah.
it's contingent upon first making sure that you replace the gender, right?
Yeah.
Okay. I was wondering if you could elaborate more on your decision on how to do that, because from reading it over again, it seemed like a gender reversal of, like, perspective, but not necessarily experience, because it seems like you put a man in the role that was a woman, but you also changed the language, which was used to be more masculine, traditionally masculine, I guess, with, like, the virile and smirks, and not just talking about the anatomy, but just the description, and I was wondering why you didn't decide to put a man and make the description more feminine as it was.
Oh, I see. Well, because I was trying to make the poem about cisgendered woman who is excited by cisgendered men, you know, and I wanted it again to be true to my experience. So I just wanted to, you know, I wanted it to be kind of funny, you know. He's a little chubby and he's, you know, and stuff like that, with these Priapus and Apollo, and, like, you know, so I wanted every time it got kind of overwrought to be kind of amusing. I didn't want it to be all, but yeah, I mean, it's a pretty traditional heterosexual erotic poem, and I stand by it from my own experience. So, you know, but I think it'll be an interesting project for somebody to take it and do something different with it, you know. And I think that's, you know, sort of one of the fun things you can do with this stuff is, all right, now I'm going to change the adjectives, and I'm going to, you know, change. I mean, I don't remember if, like, clusters and vine, I think that actually had something to do with the original. I don't remember what the original is. Does it? Yeah.
It sounds weirdly like Whitman, too.
Yeah. But, you know, that seemed to me like a nice little phallic image, too. So... yeah, no, I mean, it's a great question. The answer is I'm a boring, cisgendered, heterosexual, middle-aged lady, you know, so, yeah. Yeah.
When can you, like, in the process of writing, like, when, at what point do you say, I'm, like, done with this poem, I'm done editing?
Well, I was reading something today, and I'm like, I don't think that poem's done. Okay. So, next edition, I'll change that. Oh my God. You don't really know. I mean, and in fact, like, for example, the new poems that I read at the end, I don't know if they're done really. You know, they'll probably change. I do have a feeling like of something dynamic happening. You could, like, a lot of people can do good writing, and most of the time I'm doing what, you know, is at best good writing that's not really performing as a poem. You know, I want the poem to sort of somehow tap dance or something like that. And I want it to put on a show, whatever kind of show it is. So I guess I get a feeling of that when something is happening, I recognize it. No, sometimes over and over, like most often, I think, oh, this is great. This is great. Something's really happening here. And then, like, I'll be like... next day.
Like the next day.
What the hell? This is terrible. So there's also this desire for it to be done all the time that sort of misleads you. So you just kind of have to live with it over time. I also have people I send it to to read them, and they give me their frank opinion. That's helpful. I don't always take their advice, but useful thing to do. It's good as a writer to have people who are also working in the art with you, who you can, you know, a lot of people are like, oh, that's great, Daisy, you're so talented. And I'm like, okay, you're not being honest. Let me like find somebody, you know, let me find somebody who will really tell me what's going on. And that's extremely important, to find somebody who will be honest with you, even if it's kind of, can be kind of bruising, but it makes you a better writer.
Was there somebody who said good poems aren't ever finished, they're just abandoned?
Somebody did say that, but who said
that? Yeah, who the hell was that? Oh, well, we can Google it later.
Yeah.
So is the process for you of writing the Baudelaire poems different than writing your own poems? And how do you go about the revision process? How do you sort of figure out where you want to go?
So the process was going like this, more or less. I would look through, I had a particular Baudelaire that was translated. I didn't really like the translations very much, but it was useful. You know, had the French on one side and English on another side. I would find ones that felt good. You know, like some of them I would read and I'm like, vampire? Nah, I'm not going to do that one. You know, like he's got a lot of vampire poems or like, you know, rotten.
You turned down a vampire poem?
I did. And then there's like one about a balcony, which is just ridiculous. Like, what's the balcony? I don't know what's happening, but it's like, it's just so silly and, you know, sincere and
French.
Ridiculous. So, but I would find ones where I felt like there was some meat to it or some, you know, stuff I was interested in. I would start by feeding, I would like read it through in French, and I would kind of look at the English, but not too much, but I would put it into Google Translate. Google Translate, like, you want to hear like wooden translations. That's what you do. So like right there, I had to make it better. So I would start going through line by line, and I would just kind of start, I mean, it sounds really goofy, but I would just sort of start messing around with it. I would understand that I was working with lines of a certain length and certain meter, and I would have images I wanted to get in there, and I'd be like, oh, look where that just swerved to. I need to make a swerve right there, you know? So it was looking at structural things. But I would, when his language got too elevated and, you know, cloying with adjectives, or when mine did in response, I would try to undercut it, you know. So I was really just trying, I think, and again, this is kind of stuff I do with my own poems, which is sort of like playing with fancy language and playing with colloquial language, and what happens if one thing undercuts another? What if I have a tonal shift? What if the diction shifts? Because my sense is that there's so much that I want all language to be in the poem. So I guess I was kind of like, I want these to be Baudelaire and not Baudelaire at the same time. So, did that answer your question?
Well, I think it seems to me that there's always a process of discovery as you move your work and start doing the revisions. Mm-hmm. But within the context of a translation, you're somewhat bound by the poem itself.
Yeah. Yeah.
And where did you say, I'm not going to go further? That's the interesting question, because some places, as you say, you just say, that's an interesting spin, I'm going to go down that direction and see where it goes.
Well, the ones that were more, did I read them? I'm sorry to students, I already did this too, but, you know, there's a short one that I can read really quickly called Music, where it was a very straightforward one. It's practically a translation, but I didn't like it until I undermined it with modern language. So music like a sea, under ceiling of mist, to my pale star I set sail in clear air. Breathing huge and deep, like the canvas of a ship, I mount the backs of rollers, may night veil me. Breeze, gust, storm, convulsion, derelict ship, I vibrate. Soft feelings, mega emotions. Immense days, immense abyss, lull and lullaby me, doldrums mirror my despair. And I think, like, when I got mega emotions in there, I was like, okay, that threw a wrench in the works. Awesome. And then, you know, I think lull and lullaby me was a sort of half related, but I got to play around a little there. So whenever I think it was like when I created enough static within the poem, I knew I was onto something. So I would say when the wrench is in the works, or, you know, the brick is through the window of the poem, that's when I know it's going to be working better. So, yeah. Yeah.
Specifically for one of the newer ones you wrote, the Cookies and Windows, I was wondering what the process of writing those was, since you said you were trying to write a shorter poem. Mm-hmm. Have you actually written them all separately and combined them afterwards, or was the story
separate and combine them afterwards.
It was like, oh.
Yeah, no, I actually had 6 or 7 of them, but like I think there's 5 now, and I just for a while I was like, all right, I'm gonna sit down and I'm just gonna write, boom, like, and they're edited from that, they're revised from that, but I was like, I want to get in and out fast. I want them to do one thing and get out fast because I don't want to just, you know, I just. So what happened was I think I wrote Let's Fly to the Castle first about the ponies. My Little Pony people here? Okay. Bronies? Any bronies? No? Okay. Not admitting it. Okay. So that was the first one, and that's actually sort of the more longer developed one, but then I'm like, I want to go even shorter. So like writing about a sidewalk party I had and the sidewalk party my daughter had out front, you know, because it was COVID and we had the fire pit outside. My friend, South Village, my friends would come over and we'd drink wine, or her friends would do marshmallows. And I just was like, what's happening in front of me? Boom, and I would write it. So so they were separate. And then, but I think that I had a feeling they were a little bit too slight to stand alone. So I stuck them all under the title, and I felt like they were working better.
How did you decide which ones would go together out of the 6 or 7?
One of them just, like, didn't work very well, so I jettisoned it. I might stick it back in if it ever works, but I think the yard site one was chronologically about falling in love again, so that sort of needed to be the end. I think I felt a little bit, I think it was just organizing. It was a little bit about what happened first. It was a little bit about the energy of the piece. So, you know, one that was just all about food, and then one where it was all about, you know, my daughter burning herself, and then, you know, it was somewhat instinctive. That's when I organize a whole collection of poetry, it's somewhat that way too. A little bit like what happened first, and then mostly just sort of the record album method, you know, the fast one, the slow one, the short one, the long one. Happy one, the sad one, a little contrast so people don't get bored. So it was really like that, yeah. Yeah.
You mentioning like albums, actually raised a question for me, which is when you write, or in general, when you write poetry, do you always generally write kind of with the sort of the end goal of some sort of publication in mind, and you sort of like go in kind of phases of one collection, and then you do that, and then another one, or is it more free flowing than that?
I pretty much write until I have enough poems to go in a collection. The Baudelaire is a little bit different, just because everything started in that book with the Baudelaire. But in general, I write individual poems. I don't really write in projects. So that was another interesting thing that I had a project and I could figure out the shape of it as I was going along. Most of the time I write individual poems and then I have enough that I'm willing to show people. And then I organize them into a manuscript. They do tend to go together because I don't necessarily write literally or factually about my life, but there are certain things I'm thinking about in a set of years that I'm in. I tend to write maybe with a certain aesthetic or a certain sensibility, and so those things go together in the volume that I'm working on. But I don't set out to write a set of poems about such and such or a set of poems in a certain form or anything like that. It's much more improvisational than that. I might at some point be more deliberate. I would like to be more deliberate. It doesn't usually work out. I usually like, I'm going to write a series of poems. One time I was going to write a bunch of poems that were based on the stories of the great ballets. I don't know why. It was a dumb idea. But it's not a dumb idea. Have the idea if you can make a good book, good poems out of it. But I think I got half a poem out of it. And that, you know, that was it. And I've had other like really big plans about, you know, projects. And they never work out. So. Yes.
I was interested in swan poem, and you just talked about your sensibility.
Mm-hmm.
And I am remembering a poem you wrote and actually performed, because I saw a video of it, about City Hall.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. Now, there's a change of sensibility. Because how many years ago was that?
Mm-hmm. Well, that was a sort of special case, because Glenn Holston, the filmmaker, he was like a film projects that were always airing on public TV locally,
okay.
And he hired a bunch of local poets to write poems related to locations in Philadelphia, and he assigned me City Hall, and so I hung out there and I watched City Hall, and I don't think I'm a very good occasional poet, you know, and I don't write to assignment very well. And so what I did there was I was like, okay, I'm going to try to sort of imitate Whitman and be like expansive and listy and, you know, praising, you know, like, so that's what I did there.
Yeah, very exuberant.
Yeah, it was, well, I was like having fun. I was watching everybody, and he was, you know, and he was filming stuff, and I was like, go film that, you know, and then I went home and wrote the poem and read it. But I think that was sort of an outlier and didn't end up in any of my books.
How many years ago? Because the time difference is amazing. It's like a different city.
Yeah, that's true. That would have been in the 90s.
Yeah, now it's got all those fancy fountains and stuff.
Yeah, yeah. No, that was the 90s, and that was, you know, because City Hall was a place where people would walk. It was like crossroads, right? You know, and they have all the sculptures, and, you know, everybody, you know, so it was really fun to sit around there and watch
people
live.
Yeah.
I don't know. Maybe I should try to do a new one. A new City Hall poem. Kind of depressing. But so that was a while ago, and you know, I was a lot younger, and I didn't know as much what I was doing, which was probably good, because you can, you know, you have a kind of,
yeah, I think
energy and it's like that. Yeah.
Which was a pretty good marker, the change city,
yeah,
and the change sensibility.
Yeah, yeah.
Enormous.
Yeah.
Thanks again, folks.
Thank
there's
you.
Please take some food when you go, but there's also books for sale. A great deal back there.
Yeah, $10 each, and I'll sign them if you want.
Yeah. Thank you all. So, thanks, David.
Thank you. So,